Henry II of England and his wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine, have created and ruled the Plantagenet Empire, the most dynamic, wealthiest, and most powerful kingdom in Western Europe. But the Plantagenets are rarely at peace, and Henry's temper and ego has long troubled his family and his people, from the shocking martyrdom of Thomas Becket to the vicious Great Rebellion that saw Eleanor sent to prison for 15 years. Meanwhile, their brilliant, avaricious, rebellious children have grown, fought, ruled, married, and even died, so that of his five sons, only two survive, Richard Lionheart and John Lackland. Now, as the 12th century enters its final decade, Henry himself dies, leaving his great legacy poised at the edge of great success or great failure. Here's the story of what happens as Richard and John take their turns on the Plantagenet throne.
Welcome back to season 3 of Lion's Forge. My name is Becket, and I want to tell you a story, an epic true story of five kings and the Lion Queen. Season 3, Episode 11, Striving for Heaven. Richard Lionheart, still embroiled in his unfinished war more than 2,000 miles from home, had reason to be worried about more than Saladin's army. News had come to him that both Philip Augustus, home from the Crusade, and Brother John, handsomely bribed to leave England alone while its king was in Syria, were suspiciously making contact. It was even reported that Eleanor of Aquitaine herself had had to threaten her youngest son with the loss of every one of his holdings in England if he dared a personal meeting with the King of France. Richard was now a very worried man. The predicament he faced in England left the greatest king in Western Europe sleepless and morose, alternating between rash assaults on startled Muslim scouts and days of utter inertia when he sat staring at the floor of his tent. His actions over the next months would be confused and contradictory, as if this man, worshipped as the greatest of heroes, had suddenly lost his way. Following Plantagenet tradition, he called for a council to hear him out, telling them that he felt he had to return to England. One has to assume this would be considered the worst ill luck by his army, and perhaps their anguished reaction is the reason he did little to actually prepare to go. Instead, he shifted his attention to the Jerusalem succession once more. If he was truly headed home, someone had to take his place at the head of the crusade, and that someone had to be the King of Jerusalem. One might think this issue had already been settled, with Conrad of Montferrat and Guy of Lusignan each holding power over half the kingdom. But of course, both the competing kings and their supporting factions were discontent with this half-a-loaf compromise. Now Guy and Conrad were coming to that square on the chessboard where one of them would finally defeat his rival, win the throne, and take command of the Crusader army. But which one? Conrad and Richard weren't friends. Conrad wasn't even a reliable Plantagenet ally. The champion of Tyre spitefully refused to be of any help whatever as Richard grappled with Saladin. In fact, popular Conrad was actively trying to cut a separate peace deal with the Muslims, which would have made him an ally of Saladin's. Guy, on the other hand, was Richard's vassal, who'd proved surprisingly loyal and effective in the fight to take Cyprus, a fountain of Plantagenet tax revenue. Still, Guy couldn't shake blame for Hatton and the loss of Jerusalem, not to mention the sniping whispers that he had spent 2 years in front of Acre without winning it. It was Conrad who was admired as a great military leader, married to the only direct living heiress to Jerusalem's throne, and beloved of the French and Germans besides. Men admired Conrad. Men would serve under Conrad. Richard was a realist. He finally backed Conrad, if grudgingly, to wear the crown of the Kingdom of Jerusalem and lead the Crusader army once Richard left for England. The throne itself was admittedly still in Saracen hands, but certainly it would be redeemed in short order. What Guy got was the questionable consolation prize of Richard's permission to take hostile Cyprus off the back of the unlucky Knights Templar, who'd paid a fortune for a land they couldn't control. As it turned out, all of these plans careened off in unplanned directions like a badly aimed billiard ball. Guy's family, the Lusignans, would go on to rule Cyprus for 12 generations. As for Conrad, radiating charisma, evidently on the road to a lifetime of fabulous success, he was murdered within a month of his coronation by the notorious, mysterious assassin sect, so successful at medieval political murders that we still instantly recognize the word assassin. Saladin himself had survived 2 assassin attempts on his life. To this day, no one is sure why Conrad was killed. Had it been Richard's doing? Did Lionheart hate the man, so glorious, so arrogant and disloyal, enough to engineer his death? Maybe it was Guy of Lusignan, chafing under the unflattering comparisons to Conrad. Others thought the local head man of the assassins, Rashid al-Din Sinan, took it upon himself to get even for Conrad's piracy of one of his ships. As it turned out, Sinan is now considered the probable instigator, but at the time, men were equally suspicious of Guy and Richard. As for the citizens of Jerusalem, accustomed to succession crises by now, they simply took up a new king, a prominent crusader named Henry of Champagne. Henry had impeccable lineage. He was the grandson of Eleanor of Aquitaine and Louis Capet, the eldest child of their eldest daughter. This made him a nephew to both Richard and Philip Augustus. Probably at Richard's urging, Henry promptly married the kingdom's heiress, the still quite lovely Isabella, widowed after Humphrey of Toron died. She was now on her 3rd husband in 4 years, and pregnant to boot. Henry's family tree, linked to both the Capets and the Plantagenets, along with his marriage, satisfied everyone, at least for the time being. But there was a great deal of gossip about Conrad's shocking death, followed so very quickly by the speedy rise of Richard's nephew. As for Richard, he still seemed unable to focus. One day he'd send envoys to Saladin to negotiate a peace. The next, he went after Darum with its 17 towers and took it in 3 days. He'd get encouraging news that his mother had suppressed his troublesome brother. Then, new and different reports from England would send him back to his tent, a study in gloom. The troubled army watched, waited, heard nothing. Left to their own devices, his captains decided they would attack Jerusalem after all, a decision that promptly leaked throughout the camp, causing wild screaming joy among crusaders who had feared they would never set foot in the holy city. Some historians think the army's passionate delight at the prospect of Jerusalem reignited Richard's energy. Others say he came upon a mysterious priest who told him secret things that reassured him about his future. Whatever changed him, his men must have stood and cheered out loud when he announced that he had made up his mind to stay on for 1 more year, that the siege of Jerusalem would indeed begin. The fresh surge of passion among his soldiers apparently was the force needed to engage Lionheart. You can almost see his mind begin to work, getting his army moving toward the holy city. But there's another old story that he had the sorry experience of meeting yet another prophet, this one telling him outright that he would never win Jerusalem. the old man sealed the accuracy of the prediction by calmly announcing that he himself would be dead on the seventh day, which he was. If that story could possibly be true, it might explain the next few weeks of Richard's life. He sat in the Beit Nuba camp outside Jerusalem for a month, where we know that several things happened, although historians argue over the sequence. At least one council was called. The French and Germans who had remained with the army again argued for an attack on Jerusalem, that fundamental goal of the entire crusade. Richard's response was either petulant or, more charitably, weary to the point of exhaustion. The commanding general of the Third Crusade stood up to tell his army that a Jerusalem campaign would not succeed, that scouts had learned too little, the city's defenses were too powerful, the crusaders' supply lines too long, any potential attack too exposed. Then he made the incredible statement that if the army wanted to go anyway, he would stay on as a soldier, but he would no longer lead. This powerhouse of a man who had never been deterred from any goal by any obstacle basically sat down and said, "I quit." The staggering news crashed against every tent, every sentry station, every boy currying a horse. Thomas Asbridge, a crusade historian who thinks highly of Lionheart, described the moment as a calamitous failure of leadership, one which had a disastrous effect on morale. The Muslims heard of it within hours. Their roving attacks began to pick up momentum. Richard distanced himself from his incomprehensible ultimatum by appointing a committee of 20 to vote as to next moves. But they were his hand-picked delegates. They predictably agreed to withdraw from Beit Nuba and keep going south, not east. The situation in the Crusader camp was now entirely muddled. Richard certainly didn't step aside. He was the same man who once grandly said, "I rule. No one rules me." In Lionheart's mind, after all, the army hadn't called his bluff. No one else would volunteer to lead the men to Jerusalem, so there was no need for him to really sit on the sidelines. Emissaries still came and went, heading to and from the royal tent. He seized opportunity as it presented itself, including planning and leading the capture of a magnificent Egyptian caravan coming up to resupply Saladin. That dawn raid was so daring, so perfect, on such a tremendous scale that it awed the Saracens as much as it horrified them. The captured treasure was spectacular. Tons of food, spices, and sugar, hundreds of tents, cartloads of weapons and prized Arab medicines, strong boxes filled with gold, thousands of fresh pack animals. The Muslims were so stunned by their losses that Arab chroniclers reported Saladin genuinely feared he had just lost the war. The Crusaders now had all the food, supplies, animals, weapons, and money they could conceivably need to attack wherever they chose. Yet within a month of that glorious success, Richard and his Crusaders had moved neither east nor south, but had drifted back north to Acre. His men were tired. The French would never go anywhere but Jerusalem. Saladin could never quite be dislodged. Ever decisive, ever commanding King Richard the Lionheart was in a box. He'd have one more chance, back at Jaffa. After that, things would never be the same. Amid all the false starts and stops, the pointless days when nothing was decided and nothing happened, there would be one more glorious, unforgettable time at the end of July 1192. Jaffa, the newly won Crusader city, just then was occupied by nothing but a minor European contingent. Saladin, still alert to opportunities and badly needing a win, attacked. A 5-day battle followed, during which the Christians certainly gave as good as they got, while messengers riding for their lives got word to Richard in Acre. He raced to Jaffa with 1,000 of his men, arriving dramatically in a ship with scarlet sails, flying his scarlet banner with its 3 golden lions. He hit the beach only hours before the place would have been forced to surrender. There are reports that Richard even thought the city might already have been lost, since its walls had been breached in several places and Saracen flags billowed in the sea breeze. Then a figure on a tower in Jaffa saw Lionheart's ship approaching, jumped from the heart-stopping height, hit the sand below, ran as if chased by fire, and swam frantically toward Richard. This brave soul, some say a priest, brought word that the defenders were almost done in, but not yet defeated. Richard again lived up to his legend. That combination of ferocious personal courage and genius for combat that carried him even when overwhelming enemy forces already smelled triumph, booty, conquest. Jaffa became another Lionheart victory. Sweet, sweet tonic after the dispiriting weeks at Beit Nuba. There are reports that just the sight of the red-headed giant the Arabs called Melek Rik was enough to sweep terrified Muslim soldiers aside. Tireless as a machine, Richard drove Islam's army out of the city and then worked beside his men to fix the fresh damage to Jaffa's walls, simultaneously keeping up with a steady stream of emissaries between the two sides. It was during these negotiations that another Lionheart legend was born. The story says that he had camped with some of his men in a field outside the town, where Saladin's prowling scouts spotted them. The Sultan, ever an opportunist, quickly warmed to the idea of sending some of his best fighters to surprise the Crusaders as they slept, killing the men and capturing Richard, who would command a fantastic ransom. The plot might even have worked, except that either a sleepy knight wandered off to relieve himself in the bushes where he stumbled over circling Muslims, or 2 Saracen captains got into an argument over who better deserved the honor of capturing Lionheart. However it came about, the planned surprise failed. But Saladin's men still hit the little camp hard in the dark, half-dressed Crusaders yanked awake, forcing their sleep-addled brains to function. The fight would live on in history, half-hidden by mythology. But no one doubts that Richard was creative, intense, fast, superb, so brave himself that he could inspire incredible bravery among his men. He got them into ranks, infantry shoulder to shoulder in front, protected by their shields and by a line of braced spear points, while 2 rows of crossbowmen behind them took turns shooting and reloading, firing continuously into a Muslim attack that outnumbered them 4-1. The battle went on for hours, Richard constantly putting himself in the boiling core of the fighting, the king and his horse peppered with arrows. We still have odd stories that Lionheart struck such immense blows with his sword that he split helmeted heads in half from hairline to jaw, slashed men's shoulder joints apart. The Muslims, staggered by their casualties, finally broke and scattered. Richard had lost no more than a handful of his own men. As if any more proof could be needed, that day at Jaffa crowned Richard's reputation as the greatest soldier of the age. One story says that the Saracens so admired Richard's power and courage that when Lionheart lost his wounded horse in the thick of fighting, Saladin's brother sent a fresh mount over to help. There are other reports that when the battle ended at last, Richard still had the stamina to ride out alone in front of the Muslim army, the supreme warrior, and that Saladin sent him the gift of 2 Arabian horses suitable to a prince of his unequaled stature. For generations to come, rowdy Arab children would be startled into good behavior by hearing Melek Rik is coming to get you. But the fight at Jaffa would be the last of it. Soon after that day, which some believe the first instance of the British Army's famous Thin Red Line, Richard, worn to the bone, again fell very ill. He was so sick there is an 800-year-old memory that he asked Saladin for the courtesy of peaches chilled with snow from the mountains, the only food he could tolerate. The Crusaders were back where they had started months before, 50 miles from Jerusalem, with no one willing or able to take them there. The reality was simple. No one wanted to fight anymore. Richard was exhausted physically and plagued by the reality that he needed to be in England. He wanted Ascalon, not Jerusalem, while his men were tired of endless deadly struggle that never got them to the Holy City. For his part, Saladin fully understood that his own people too were tired. More fighting would gain very little. His greatest remaining asset was his simple ability to stay where he was, outlasting the invaders. And so it would end, this third crusade, crumpled, tired, worn. The two magnificent leaders, men who never met in person, agreed through their ambassadors to a 3-year truce. The Christians remained in possession of Tyre, Jaffa, and Acre, with Acre to be the new capital of the Latin East. Ascalon, where Richard had invested so much ambition, so much labor, and so much money, the tantalizing gateway to Egypt, was returned to Saladin, who again burned it to the ground to remove it as a crusader temptation. Jerusalem, too, remained in Saracen hands, although Saladin guaranteed rite of passage for Europeans to the holy places. Within hours, crusaders began to stream into the city they had worshipped from afar their entire lives. Richard was not among them. Despite his crusader's vow, he never set foot there. There's a story that he rode close enough to pray within sight of it, but wouldn't allow himself to look its way since he had failed to free it from the infidels. Saladin's final message to Richard has survived a millennium. It's said that Saladin had such an exalted opinion of King Richard that he would rather lose his dominions to him than to any king he had ever seen, although the sly coda was, if he was obliged to lose his dominions at all. Despite such witty grace as they parted ways, Saladin must have thrown himself to his knees in gratitude to his God, since the Muslims were played out, ruinously short of money, of men, of will. They couldn't have withstood a concentrated push, but it no longer mattered. The Third Crusade was over. While the fabled Outremer had been given a new footing in Cyprus that would remain intact for centuries, the Arabs had endured just long enough. Europe would launch more crusades, struggling repeatedly for a different outcome. But no crusader would regain Jerusalem. The true cross was never recovered. The greatest of all Christian relics simply disappeared. The prized Latin states would ultimately dwindle over little more than 100 years to a minuscule strip along the Mediterranean coast. The West would not re-expand its footprint in the Middle East until the Ottoman Empire collapsed of its own weight early in the 20th century. Saladin had little time to take pleasure in his victory, so closely won. He would be dead within a year, leaving his 17 sons to fight over their father's legacy. Richard Lionheart's life was about to undergo such radical change that one might say it would soon be unrecognizable. Both had earned immortality, at least in human terms, leading their people who all gave so much to the dream of Jerusalem. Infinite courage, fidelity to God, desperate toil, terrible suffering, treasures accumulated over lifetimes. For the Europeans, it had come to little, thrown to the wind and the sands, covered up and lost forever. they were left with their memories of how it felt to fight for God. Soldiers to the death, striving for heaven under the eternal sun of an eternal desert day. We've come to the end of our story for the time being. I am Beckett Arnold, narrating from the book Lion's Forge, adapted for us by the author Karen Markle Knapp. Thank you to Francis Butt for voicing our introduction and so much more. If you like what you hear, please give us a rating, follow our channel, and share us with your friends. Most importantly, please join us again February 10th for the next episode of Lion's Forge, available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts, including on YouTube with video episode trailers. Visit us on Facebook, where you can ask questions, leave reviews, and interact with me. Until next time, thank you for listening.